today's webinar. It is on preparing, you know, for transition, and we've got a really knowledgeable panel today that's going to be talking about different aspects in the transition process. The first person I'm going to introduce, I'm going to just introduce her, and I'm going to let her run with this, is Joanne Tanner. Joanne holds an MBA with an emphasis in strategic planning, and I've known Joanne a long time, and really she has a passion for dental, and it was ignited when she served in the United States Navy, and I always had a tremendous respect for her for that. As a technician, dental hygienist, she's worked with hundreds of dental practices across the U.S., I think I've known Joanne for 15, 20 years, I think. We go back a long ways. But she's worked with a lot of practices, and she's really kind of honed and focused at giving skills and training staff on really what it takes to succeed. So Joanne is the owner of the Tanner Management Team and provides dental professionals with, management skills and really what it takes to succeed in today's dental world. So I'll let you take it away, Joanne.
Thank you so much, Bill. I appreciate that warm introduction. We have an exciting evening tonight. I'd like to introduce Mr. Travis Slade. He's a principal of Thomas Dahl, located in Walnut Creek, California. Travis's team does retirement plan administration, wealth management, with over 600 dental clients. He's lectured at all the California dental schools, component dental societies, and several study clubs. Prior to joining Thomas Dahl, Travis worked for Anderson Tax. He received his bachelor's degree in accounting from Brigham Young University. Travis also helped his brother, who's a dentist, in the early stages of career. So he has a very unique perspective on the challenges facing dentists today. He's a member of the Academy of Dental CPAs. It's a group of 30 CPA firms across the country. They specialize in working with dentists. We'd also like to welcome another speaker tonight, Whitney Tharelson, with the CEO and founder of the Tharelson Group, the premier real estate brokerage in California exclusively for dentists. Whitney started the boutique brokerage in 2017 in order to improve the process of buying and selling dental practices and to help her clients take the next step in their careers. Whitney has extensive experience in the dental industry, and she spent the majority of her career working with dentists. She has worked as a dental and commercial real estate broker in Southern California since 2011. Whitney's services include dental practice sales, medical building sale and purchase, landlord and tenant representation, and practice appraisal. Whitney works and lives in Newport Beach, California. Next on our speaker lineup is Ali Amranchian. And Ali is one of the nation's leading dental lawyers on the topics relevant to dentists. His clients seek his advice on practice acquisitions and sales, creation of corporations and partnerships, associate contracts, employment law matters, office leasing, and state board defense. He's the founder and Dental Medical Counsel. This is a law firm which is regarded as the preeminent dental law firm devoted to dental entrepreneurs. In addition to the law firm, he founded HR for Health, which is the leader in providing web-based human resource solutions and advice for dentists, ensuring HR compliance for the dental practices, protecting them from employment law risks. So tonight, we're talking about a vision. The vision that some people this evening are thinking about buying a practice. Some of you already own a practice. And we have dentists joining us. Some of them are still in dental school. So I welcome all of you this evening. So those of you that are thinking about buying a practice, we have a vision. And what we'd like to do tonight is to talk to you about what are your options when you decide to buy that particular practice. So I know tonight, if you're here thinking about buying, where do I start? Where do I want to live? Location is the most important because you need to decide where you want to live. Where are you going to put your practice? And we have a fabulous broker with us tonight, and I encourage you to call all the brokers if you are buying, because you need to know where all the practices are for sale. If you're thinking about buying a practice, we want to make sure that you understand how many treatment rooms do you want. If there are only 3 treatment rooms, remember, you need to use the facility 30 days a month. After all, you are paying for rent 30 days a month. Or is there room for possible expansion? I know Travis and his team like to talk about, don't let the $800,000 practice scare you away. In fact, that $1 million practice has a better cash flow than the smaller $300,000 or $400,000 practice. So we encourage you, first of all, you start with your CPA to make sure that the practice will cash flow. Now, I realize the number of active patients does not change the value. The number of active patients is important. So we can determine how many patients you have. What is the treatment philosophy? When we work with doctors, when they are looking at buying a practice, we want to take a look, how are they diagnosing the treatment? Because if you see treatment that's being referred out, that can be a plus. If you're seeing treatment, maybe crowns that you wouldn't necessarily recommend, or I remember maybe 3 or 4 years ago, I remember a doctor taking a look at the charts, and she discovered that every new patient needed SRPs if they had insurance. And I remember calling Ali on that way home that night, because that could be a potential problem that philosophy didn't reach. One of the important things in California is how much delta is in the practice. Recently, we had a seller tell us that they had 25% of their practice was Delta Dental. So I said, that's interesting. How did you come to find that there was 25%? They said, well, we took the Delta 1099. It was $250,000. We collected $1 million. So therefore, Delta is 25%. However, doctors, that doesn't tell us the entire picture. That is only the Delta Dental percentage, not the matching copay. So when we run the PPO wizard, and within this wizard, we were able to determine 58% of the insured patients, 47% of all patients in this practice had Delta. We're able to use the PPO wizard when the seller has Dentrix, EagleSoft, and Open Dental. Travis and his teams really appreciate this, because then they can update the cash flow to see how everything will come to fruition. So those are the established doctors, and we have many dentists that are considering selling in a few years. I welcome you this evening, and I want you to find out, has dentistry really become the easier part of your day? It really has, and you need to know your practice numbers. I ask many of the doctors, how many of you are reappointing your hygienist? Oh, Joanne, we're phenomenal. We pre-appoint 90%. However, when we do the math, we find out that it's only about 72% on the reappointment. And so within this measurement, within this KPI, key practice indicators, we found out that there were 100 patients 6 to 9 months past due. We found another 85. We found another practice within the practice. And you know what it was, team? When we closed down for COVID, we all shut down our reminders. Do you know some practices, they turned the reminders on with appointments, but sometimes the frequency for the past due, it was defaulted to 1, 3, 6, 12 months past due. What happens to month 2, 3, 4 through 7 and 11? In other words, go home, go back to the office, check your frequency for the reminders, because we need to go through and welcome back those patients. We'll create flyers for our practices, and this is not going to be a home run, but it's enough to give the patients another reminder and maybe a reason to come back and send them a welcome back email. COVID has taught us many things. It's also told us, get rid of the clipboard. All right, we want to get rid of some of the paper. And when you send out that referral to the specialist, and I believe there are a few specialists with us tonight, when you receive that referral, well, you know what? Sometimes you don't even realize that you got the referral because the piece of paper is in the bottom of the patient's briefcase, or maybe it didn't even make it home with the patient. There is a free, yes, I said a free program called Refera for you to send and track referrals. But one of my favorite parts about it is the specialists can easily send their post-op reports. I don't have as much time tonight to talk about that, but I know Ali really likes this because of the reduction in liability. Lastly, I'd like to welcome all of the existing doctors that if you do have Dentrix, Eaglesoft, or Open Dental, we'll do a complimentary practice assessment to see how you measure up with all the other dentists nationwide. One other big marketing idea. Right now, when you go to restaurants, how many of you are given a QR code to take a picture with your cell phone? So it gave me an idea. More Google reviews, take your QR code, and we'll put it into a flyer for you because Google is king. The more reviews there, it will help with your positioning. So I'd like to welcome Travis, and he's going to take control of the mouse. And Travis Slade, dental CPA, we're in for a treat. And it's his turn to now.
Okay, Travis, I think you should have control. Hello, Travis, can you hear us? Hello, Travis.
Travis, I think you're muted. We can't hear you.
He's going to check his microphone.
Can you hear us, Travis? Let's see if I could.
Do you want Whitney to take over? Let's go to Whitney right now. Travis is taking care of his microphone. And Bill, if you could switch over to Whitney's PowerPoint, please.
Okay. Whitney, if you can go ahead and take control of the screen, you can go ahead and advance to the next section.
Okay. Let's see.
Just keep going forward. There you go. The other way. There you go. And keep going. And
can you,
you
hear me now,
right
by chance?
Oh, yes. We can hear you now.
Okay. Travis.
All right, Travis, you're up.
My computer did this to me earlier this week, where it changed my microphone setting.
You're fine.
I didn't think it would do it right here. Can you still hear me, okay?
Yeah, we can hear you just fine. Request the control from Whitney.
Okay, yeah.
The address on my phone. Do you want to change the other maps?
Okay, you should have control, Travis.
All right. Wow. I think everything that could go technically wrong with a webinar is going technically wrong. obviously, 12 months of COVID, we haven't learned haven't learned how to be savvy enough with technology. So sorry about that. So let me make sure this is working. There we go. So first of all, let me thank Joanne for putting this on. She put a lot of work into doing this. And I don't know anyone that eats or sleeps dental stuff more than Joanne. I think this is literally what she dreams about. And she cares so much about the dental community at large. So grateful for Joanne. Grateful to be here with Whitney. Met her a few times at the CDA back when we had CDA in person. And grateful to be with Ali, who I don't know how Ali does everything he does. I'm pretty sure he's figured out how to clone himself because Ali is everywhere and always on the top of his game. So grateful to be with Ali. So Thomas Saul is an accounting firm for dentists. We work with a lot of clients across California mostly. And we're part of the Academy of Dental CPAs. Joanne scheduled this webinar because we wanted it to be after the tax deadline. Little did we know the tax deadline would get pushed. And so I didn't have a lot of time to prepare. So I'm sure there's some typos in my slides. So if you find one, you win a couple bonus points here. And I'm actually gonna skip quite a few slides. The presentation that we're doing today is about transitions. And as an accountant, similar to an attorney and consultant, we work with sellers and buyers quite often. So we get to see both sides of the transaction and maybe some shortcomings that come along with that. And so today I think there's a lot of things we could talk about, but I'm just going to pick a couple topics that I think get overlooked quite a bit. For both buyers and sellers. And so I'm going to skip a couple slides. I don't know why there we go. I'm even going to skip my government lending slide. I was going to put a plug in there to get your employee retention credit before you file your tax return. If you're a practice, okay, I'll just do it. I'm going back. I said I wasn't. So This is what I've been all I've been doing the past year is really helping clients get the most out of all these government programs. And one quick comment, because I'm seeing a lot of people not do this in the dental community. A lot of dentists qualify for an employee retention credit. And so you should go get your employee retention credit. And if you do, it has to be reflected on your 2020 tax return. So your tax returns that are due in a couple of weeks, you want to get your employee retention credit before you file that. And you'll probably need to go on extension. So go get your employee retention credit. Contact us if you need help with that. The other thing is you have until the end of this month to get a PPP loan if you haven't already. But one thing to note is we've seen a lot of clients get the incorrect amount for PPP loans, and you can fix those. So if you think for some reason your PPP amount is too low, either one or two, it's not too late to fix that by the end of the month. You want to get started on that because it's kind of a slow process. But on average, people that like come to us and are like, hey, check out my PPP loan. Most people are leaving like $10,000 to $15,000 on the table with the PPP loans being the wrong amount. And the employee retention credit on average is about $35,000, just FYI. All right, I won't talk about any, I'm just going to talk about transitions now. No more COVID stuff. So I'm going to skip some slides here. Look at all this accounting lingo you're going to miss here. I know your hearts are broken. I'm just going to talk real quick. I'm even going to skip this and come back if I have time. I want to talk about Delta Dental real quick. I know most people probably understand it, but I still see it come up all the time. So I just want to talk about what happens or what's happening right now for you, the old doc who is a Delta Premier only provider and your life feels great. And here's what's happening. you have a Delta patient who signed up for a PPO plan, and they come to your office, and even though they have a PPO plan, because you're a Premier only provider, Delta is going to reimburse you for doing a crown. In this example, let's say it's a crown on this patient, they reimburse you $1,000. And what happened here is the Delta PPO patient paid for a Toyota. They come to you and they get a Lexus, and Delta pays you a Lexus. They reimburse you. So Delta has this problem where they're collecting money for a Toyota and they're giving out Lexuses, right? So that's not a good problem to have. And so Delta is trying to cut this problem off as soon as they can and as often as they can. And they use the transition as an opportunity to cut you off, to change this relationship. And to now, if a PPO patient comes to your office and there's a new owner, young doc, they're making them take the PPO fees, which they could be doing the same exact crown on the same exact patient, but because it's the new young doc, they're only going to get paid $800 for this crown. And generally the haircut is 20 to 30%. Each procedure code is different and each zip code is different to determine the Delta haircut. But the reason it's a problem is and it's a problem that's not your fault, right? It's not the dental community's fault, but we kind of have to deal with it. And a lot of these younger docs are looking at practices, and if it's a Delta heavy practice, they're going to do the same exact work that the selling doctor is doing and going to make a lot less, and they're going to have some debt service on top of that. And sometimes the math doesn't make sense. Literally, you know, we do the math and it's this buyer's going to make $60,000 a year after the Delta haircut. So your options, the reason I bring this up is I don't want you to get surprised if you're a seller or if you're a buyer. You should know ahead of time that this is going to be an issue that comes up. People are going to ask, are you a Delta Premier only provider? And if so, how much of your practice is Delta? And so a couple options for a seller. So what are your options? Let's say you're, 5 years away from selling your practice or less, and you want to get ahead of this. One option is to go out of network before you sell. Now, I know it probably seems like a daunting task for many of you. If, you're grandfathered into Premier and your life is good. But it's something that can significantly increase the value of your practice. So a fee-for-service practice is going to go super fast and get a really high value. If it's not, if you stay in network, your practice will probably sell for a lower price. And depending on the amount of Delta you have, it could be a significant haircut when you sell your practice. And that might be okay for some people, because you don't need a big inflow of cash when you sell your practice because you've been funding your retirement plan and you have other funds, and you're not, hopefully your retirement isn't dependent on selling your practice. Obviously you want to get the most you can, but that's an option, is just stay in network and know that you're going to get, a lower price for your practice. Another option is to just try to find an uneducated buyer, right? I'm going to stay in network and I just want to find some poor sucker who doesn't know what he's doing, right? I don't think anyone wants to do that. I will say this has been happening since 2011-ish. And for the first 5 years, I don't think a lot of people really knew what was going on. And so there were a lot of uneducated buyers and sellers. No one really knows. It's not like any sellers were trying to do this, but I think a lot of people bought practices not realizing this was happening. If you're a seller or if you're a buyer and you're coming into the situation, really it's kind of a take it or leave it, right? And there are situations where you can be okay with the Delta haircut. And I would say the focus should be on cash flow. So what is your cash flow after debt service and after the Delta haircut that you're going to have. And we help our clients look at this and feel good about the numbers, like Joanne was saying. We're looking at a practice with Joanne, and in the prospectus, the language they said was, it was an ortho practice. They said, we only see a couple Delta patients per year, is what they said. And then they didn't say anything else about Delta. Well, we started digging a little bit because we know that sounded a little fishy. And it was 25% of the practice was Delta, right? So like we run the numbers, and it was a $100,000 haircut on this practice. And it was pretty significant. Now, at the end of the day, the practice was very profitable. And even after Delta, it still made sense for the buyer. So he's still going to go forward with it. But his eyes are wide open in what he's doing. The other thing is just to walk away, right? So as much as a buyer might be upset that the practice, you know, has this, there's only so much you can do. So you either are okay with it or you walk away. So that's the first thing we see a lot of. The other thing I want to talk about is the tax issues that come up with when you buy or sell a practice. So there's always this allocation of the purchase price. And, if you sell your practice for $1 million, some of that $1 million is going to be allocated to supplies, some of it to equipment, and some of it to goodwill. And there's a couple different reasons we do that for us accountants, because we love to make life more complicated than it needs to be. So the first thing is for the buyer. So let's just pretend you're buying a practice. You paid $1 million for it. You should know that you are going to write off that $1 million. You're going to get a write-off for it. It's just a matter of how soon. And so when we allocate the purchase price, we're deciding how quick you can write it off, not if you're going to write it off. And so, if it's allocated to equipment, you're going to write it off faster than if some of it's allocated to goodwill. And so we usually try to push the buyer to allocate as much as possible to equipment. And you might think, well, isn't how the equipment's worth a scientific number, just whatever, you know, the equipment is worth? Not really. We just kind of make up the numbers during a transition. And sometimes we, you know, tweak it to newer equipment or older, but, you know, really it's you have a general sense on the percentage of the total price, how much should be equipment and how much should be goodwill. And the buyer wants as much to equipment as possible, but he should remember, or she, that it's just a timing issue. So if some gets to goodwill, it's not the end of the world. You're still going to get a write-off for it. Now, the seller, it's much different. The seller has a permanent tax situation that's coming. When they sell the practice, they're going to jump up into the absolute highest tax bracket and get taxed on this practice. Now, if part of the price is allocated towards equipment, the seller gets taxed at ordinary tax rates, which currently max out at 37%. We don't like that if you're a seller. However, goodwill gets taxed at long-term capital gains rates, which cap out around 20%. And so as a seller, you want as much of the allocation to be towards goodwill as possible.
You can put in one person and the other have to be in a vicinity though.
Usually we again, it's a timing issue for the buyer, a permanent issue for the seller.
And
as someone who's represented both sides, I'm usually more sympathetic for the seller, because I know at the end of the day, the buyer is going to get the write-off. One quick comment on this. There has been a new, a host of new legislation proposed out there. And this new legislation has a serious impact on this allocation of price, of the purchase price. Specifically, a couple weeks ago or a week ago, the American Families Plan was released by President Biden. And President Biden has come out with three kind of bills that are totaling $6 trillion and spending. And part of the funding from this is coming from an increase in tax rates. The first one is increasing the ordinary income tax rate from 37% to 40%. They're marketing it as 39.6%, but I think we can round to 40%. The other one is the capital gains rate. Historically caps out at 20%. They're going to double that to 40%. And so now, the good thing is it's simpler, right? Because everything's taxed at 40%. These are federal tax rates. But if you think about selling your practice and going from a 20% tax rate to a 40% tax rate on a big chunk of your purchase price, $1 million practice, this is kind of a big deal, in my opinion. And you want to know ahead of time what your taxes are going to be. And, you know, anytime you sell your practice, you want to try to minimize your tax liability, right? And so, you know, there's things that we can talk about in other discussions about front loading a defined benefit plan, which is something you could do to get a huge deduction in the year you sell your practice. Maybe you do seller financing and do installment agreements to spread it out over time. There are a few things you could potentially do, but more than anything, you want to be aware of what's happening and know ahead of time. Let's see. Yeah. Oh yeah. So this was proposed a couple weeks ago. If you're thinking to yourself, I better hurry and sell my practice before these tax rates go into effect, it's possible they go into effect this year. It might be too late. We don't know. It's possible it goes into effect next year. There's really no telling the timing on this. And so don't think that if you sell your practice this year, you're sure to, get out of those tax rates.
Like your thoughts are broken.
We just don't know. The other thing is, if we go back 4 years ago, there was the other side of the aisle had the presidency and Congress, and they did some sweeping tax changes in the other direction. So there might be the thought of like, I'll just wait another 4 years. And, we're just on this tax roller coaster, right? There's really no guarantee what the tax future will hold. And so I wouldn't hold off selling your practice just for hoping for better tax rates, although it's tempting. So just something to keep in mind as you think about this, and it's kind of a bummer news, and we'll see what ends up happening, but definitely something to be aware of coming up. That's it for me. I'll turn it over to Whitney.
Thank you, Travis. Great.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much, Travis. That was very informative. I didn't know some of the things you talked about, so thank you so much. So now we're going to talk about how to prepare your practice to sell from a dental broker's perspective. I think the key is to be proactive and informed. There are so many easy things you can do to maximize your sales price of your practice, things from a broker's perspective, things that Travis could help you with, things that Joanne could help you with. So it doesn't, no matter when you plan to sell, there are things that you can always do. Sometimes I talk to dentists, actually, oftentimes I talk to sellers who know they want to sell in a few years and they're just trying to gather information. I also speak to many sellers who are like, when can you come? I'm ready to go right now. So, and then buyers is the same thing. It oftentimes takes buyers quite a long time to find what they're looking for. And Joanne can definitely, Joanne has experienced that. So I'm just going to give you, some behind the scenes things about what you can do to prepare to sell or to buy. Let me click to the next slide. So the goals on this webinar, my portion, is to help you determine your current practice value, to give you tools that you can use today, right now, give you a time frame to sell during this uncertain environment, And why should you prepare your practice now? Because as Travis said, we do not know what the future holds. We do not know what the taxes are going to be like. No one has a crystal ball. If 2020 taught us anything, it's that we should be prepared for anything. So I think it's good to just be prepared. You know, when you do want to sell, you have all the knowledge, and knowledge is completely within your control. So why else should you prepare now? To maximize your sales price, improve your buyer pool, decrease days on market, and to help with a smooth transition. All important things from a broker's perspective. So as I mentioned before, there are many things that you can do. Here are some of them. You can improve upon your online presence, upgrade your equipment and technology, improve your first impression, improve your profitability, work with a dental CPA to improve your collections and your different expense categories, and to improve your practice efficiency. So today I'm going to talk about two of those items. The first thing is profitability and collections, and we're going to start with a quote by Richard Branson that I really like. Never take your eyes off the cash flow because it's the lifeblood of business. And no matter what business you're in, this is really important because without cash flow, there is no business. So cash flow, I think, really is the lifeblood of business, of your practice. I can't tell you how many hours I spend each week analyzing collections and profitability. And I am not a CPA, but this is the job of a broker, in my opinion. So collections and profitability are a big indicator of the price. That is one of the most important things that I look at when I'm pricing a practice. And I do an intensive analysis before I actually come up with a price. If your broker is not doing this, then I think it's a big problem. So I'm just going to give a brief overview of what collections and profitability actually mean, because I get a lot of people asking me what collections are. So collections are the act of receiving goods or income for a service. So in layman's terms, it's the gross number listed on your financial statements. Profitability is the ability to generate revenues in excess of expenses. So basically, how much are you taking home? And again, this is a very basic overview of what this means. Sometimes I have, when I ask doctors what the collections are, they don't understand that it's the gross revenues. They think it's actually collecting. So that's why I wanted to just give you this, definition really quick. Another thing that is really important is the net income. So net income is total collections minus total expenses divided by total collections. So, a healthy dental practice should have a net income of 30% minimum. Anything higher than that, I consider it like a cherry on top of the cake. So I was working with the owner of a large practice a few years ago, and I was talking to him about selling his practice. He sent me his tax returns. I did my analysis, and I found that he had a net income of only 15%. After all the ad backs, and I will briefly talk about what ad backs are in a few slides. He wanted top dollar for his practice because it was in a really great area close to the beach. And he had heard that practices in Southern California sell for 85% of collections. That is true in some cases, but I just couldn't work with this seller I couldn't work with him at that moment because I knew, you know, the buyers are very savvy now. So buyers, that is great that you know what you're doing and you hire experts to help you understand what you're buying. But I just couldn't work with this because I knew the buyers, you know, wouldn't want it and we wouldn't be able to get financing. So I advised him to improve upon, you know, his expenses, so that we actually have a chance to sell it for a reasonable price. So in that situation where it's a big practice and low net income, we've got to price it really low, you know, which the sellers never want to hear. So if you're selling your practice and thinking about it, I would highly, highly suggest that you call Travis and he can help you work on your expenses and different categories, because there are set industry standards. You know, for example, your wages should not be higher than 28%. There's a range for everything. Your rent should not be higher than 10%. Supplies, you know, and Travis can tell you all about that and how to improve it. So the next most important thing that I always look at is cash flow. So this is a brief overview of add backs. So I just want to show you how I arrive. Oops, let me go back. Sorry about that. So I just want to give you a really high overview, if I can go back, there we go, of how I arrive at the net income. I think you can, oh, there it is, okay. So this practice has a net income of 37%. The total gross income or collections was 1.25 minus returns and allowances. So the total is 1,235,000. So basically, you know, everyone with a corporation has add backs, and add backs are basically, we are adding the income back to the net income. So we're showing a higher profitability. On this person's tax returns, they would not want this high of a net income. So I go through, sometimes I use the general ledger, which shows the line by line expenses. So depreciation is always added back. Interest, always added back. A lot of doctors pay family members through their business, so that is added back. So this person paid $152,000 to the family members, doctor salary, et cetera, et cetera. So this is how I arrive at the net income. And anytime, you know, even before I start working with a seller, I have to do this analysis to see what we should price it at. Practice, I would consider a really healthy practice overall. Most practices I start working with when I initially look at their tax return, they show a net income of about 20%. But I plug it into my formula and I'm able to find a lot of, you know, expenses to add back, which helps us with our net income. So as a buyer, you should be doing this with your CPA. Sometimes the brokers will provide general ledgers, which show all the expenses in all the categories. I actually, you know, analyze all of that and I look at everything. I talk to the seller, their accountant. So anything you get from me is going to be clean because I've spent hours cleaning it up. So the next thing we're going to talk about is a brief overview of pricing. So there's a lot of misconceptions out there about how to price a practice, and I hear them all. So first of all, pricing a practice is not an exact science. It is kind of difficult to come up with the price, and there's a lot of things to consider and look at. It's not as easy as just saying, oh, let's take the average of the last 3 years. I don't know where that came from, but I hear it all the time and it's not true. So in a few slides, I'm gonna tell you about all the things we look for to determine the price. So I think a dental broker is needed to determine the price, or someone that really understands the industry. Brokers understand, you know, not only all the financials and tax returns and profitability and the practice, but we also understand the buyer pool, the area, the demographics, all of that. So the things I look at during to price something are location. Is it, you know, a freestanding building, medical building, shopping center, etc. There are certain buyers only want shopping centers. Other buyers only want freestanding. So it really, so I do look at that. The real estate, are they selling the real estate? Do they own it? Overhead, what is that like? Cash flow, really important. Goodwill, how much goodwill do they have? Do they have 5 years or 30 years? 30 years is obviously going to be more valuable. Facility size. I've been getting a lot of sellers call me and they only have three operatories. and the demand for three operatories is just really low because every single buyer that calls, they ask me, oh, is there room to expand? No, there's not room to expand. So, you know, that can play in. I would say the sweet spot is like 4 to 5 operatories. Anything more than that is great, as long as they're utilizing it. So the staff, how long has the staff been there? Number of operatories, procedures performed. So, you know, is this practice bread and butter dentistry, or are they doing like 20% ortho? That's going to factor into the price. Associate doctor, do they have one? Days of hygiene, time and current location. So I look at all of those things. I was working on a deal and we had a buyer and they said that they saw another practice kind of nearby, 3 or 4 miles away. And it was the same price. And they said, oh, well, this one is priced at X amount of collections, which was significantly lower. And they actually had the practice profile. They sent it to me. And the practice was declining year over year significantly. It was a different insurance size, new staff, only I think like 5 or 6 years of goodwill. So I just basically told the buyers, it's like comparing apples and oranges. It's not like real estate where we have comps to look at to price something. I don't really care what else is out there, you know, because it's not going to change the pricing of whatever I'm selling, because it, all of these things really factor in. So that is a big thing to think about. So going back to the pricing. So here's an example I put together. So this is what I would look at for normal pricing. I look at all of those things, but ultimately it comes down to the collections net income. So this practice, it's very consistent, really, really consistent. I love to see this, 37%, 40%, 39%. The collections are very consistent year over year. So this practice, if it was a bread and butter practice with days of hygiene, located in a good area, lots of goodwill, seller retiring, all the things that I look at, then I, and if it was located in, you know, a good area, say for example, Orange County, I would price this at $850,000. And that's just a, I would say between $800,000, $850,000, but that's probably the max I would price it for. COVID pricing is a little bit different. Last year during COVID and this year I have been extremely busy. I didn't really notice COVID except for wearing a mask. And so COVID pricing, I look at the same thing except COVID, I do calculations for monthly income as well. And the base will ask for monthly income. Some banks will ask for monthly income as well. So I do the calculation, say this is 2021 first quarter. COVID year, I would divide this by the number of months. I would divide the total number of collections divided by the months that they were open. And I don't know if this is what everyone's doing, but this is what I'm doing, and I have found that it has worked well to price a practice. So basically, this practice, you can see, it has remained very consistent.
Over, basically, even in Orange County, Stephanie, you might have paid $1.2 million
over. Oh, yes.
They said the missing part of the equation was not even patient pool. If they priced their whole inventory at $850 maximum, they still bought it at $2.
So this practice, sorry, I'm just listening to the background conversation. So this practice is doing really well. So let me just ask you guys, take a guess, what do you think this practice would be priced for? Does anyone have any guesses? In the chat, type it in the chat. If you can see the chat. Well, no one has any guesses. So I'm guessing you guys are all stumped about this. So COVID, I am considering 2020, but someone says 500,000. 500,000. Okay. Anyone else want to take a guess? This $1 million practice in 2017, 18, 19, $1 million practice. Where is the Delta Premier analysis? This practice has no Delta Premier. This just has PPO, 1.5 million. Okay, I like these guesses. These are, wow, okay, 650. Okay, 850,000. 800,000. Okay, that's it. All right. Well, this practice, whoever said 850,000, guess what? You're exactly right. So COVID pricing, I'm pricing it at no higher than 100% of collections. Oops, I can't go to the next slide. Sorry. Right now I'm pricing practices at 100% of whatever they did in 2020. It can't really be priced higher than that because, you know, the banks won't lend on it and buyers won't purchase it. So yes. So basically that is telling you that it hasn't changed from COVID pricing, which is shocking to me too, but that's what I'm seeing in the market. So the next thing I'm going to talk about briefly, I think I might be going over my time, but I'm just going to be really quick. So the next thing I think is really important is first impressions. So this, oops, you never get a second chance to make a first impression. So I think they say it takes 7 seconds to make a first impression about someone. And honestly, I think it's the same when you look at a dental practice online or you walk in the door or you see the outside, you decide whether or not, you know, you like it. And then, you know, they're going to look at all the numbers and everything. So easy things you can do are to stage your practice. You might want to work with a decorator, just make sure everything goes together, everything flows, looks good, cohesive. Easy thing you can do is clean, 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 clean everything. A lot of times, like I go into offices and there's like cobwebs all over the windows and the windows are shut. And the first thing I do, I was working with a seller a few months ago, and every time we were there, whether it was the due diligence, the open house, I was like, okay, we got to open all the windows. We have to make sure all the light, you know, comes in and everything. And then just organize. So that's really easy. I had one open house where it was really outdated with wallpaper and, you know, the scuffs on the wall and stuff like that. And a few buyers came to the open house and they were just commenting on how, you know, terrible the wallpaper is and how they wanted to do this and that and telling up the list of things they had to do when they took over. And that's not what you want if you're trying to sell your practice. You don't want to give anyone a reason to, you know, say negative things about your practice. So here's an example of an outdated practice. So I can even advise you on what to do. There have been instances where I have done the staging myself. I brought a hammer with me. I bought some artwork. I hung it in the waiting room. And, you know, in that situation, that buyer actually bought the practice because they walked in and they said, wow, this is great. So in this situation, you know, the curtains have to go, the carpet has to go. Oops, that's not supposed to go to the next one. So here's a nice modern practice. And it's not just that it's brand new and remodeled. It's just that all the colors go together and it is very cohesive. So that's what you want. You want a cohesive color scheme, you know, and just have everything clean and organized. So the next thing is the time frame. Basically, it's taking, if you're getting financing, which most of us would get financing, it's taking about 60 days to get everything done. The banks, you know, they've kind of come back, but some banks, they're still pretty slow. If you are lucky enough to find a cash buyer, then we can close in 2 weeks, a week, 2 weeks. So I just closed a deal like 3 weeks ago and it was a 2 week close, you know, because if it's a cash buyer, why do we need to drag it out? So I'm offering a free opinion of value for attending this webinar. Thank you so much to everyone. Thank you, Joanne, for putting this on and Bill for coordinating everything. And I love social media. I'm big on social media. So if you want to connect, you can just find me here, Google my name. No one else has my name. And that's it. So I'm going to hand it over to Ali now.
Thank you, Whitney.
Thank you. All right, there we go. All right, Ali, you're up.
Awesome, Whitney. Thank you. Thank you. I don't know if I have access to it yet.
Ali, could you request it?
There we go.
Gotcha. There you go. You should have control here shortly.
Awesome, awesome, wonderful. All right, everyone. Well, welcome to tonight's presentation. I know a lot of you are not muted, and so if you can mute your screen so we can go through the presentation quickly tonight. My portion is the legal portion, and we're going to talk very quickly about all the different aspects that you as a buyer and as a seller need to keep in mind as we kind of get into this. As Joanne mentioned, this is all I do. I'm a dental attorney focusing on transitions and partnerships and associateships. So, but tonight's not about me. It really is about you. So this is what we've learned so far between Travis, Whitney, and Joanne. We know we've talked about when to sell and how to maximize the practice of the value of your practice. We've talked about transition timing a little bit, financial analysis, and some tax planning, you know, keeping those in mind. So now we're going to talk about sales process and the legal considerations that you need to keep in mind pre and post sale. And usually, you know, we go through this over an hour's time frame because there's a lot to cover, but we're going to go through some of the more important items as we end tonight. And I promise to get you out before 7 o'clock. So here's the first steps, and this is the same steps if you're a buyer or you're a seller. And the first step is a letter of intent. And the letter of intent, as it sounds like, is a non-binding document, but it should not be taken for granted. It should not be taken for granted. And the reason is because all the terms in the letter of intent, all the terms in the letter of intent get transferred to the asset purchase agreement. So you don't get a second bite at that apple unless the facts, the data, the information that's provided to you is completely wrong and you based your offer on some wrong information, which doesn't happen, especially when you're working with brokers as experienced as Whitney is. That just doesn't happen usually. So when you're submitting a letter of intent as a buyer, make sure that it is absolutely the deal that you're comfortable living with. And usually you do that in the beginning. In other words, you get some financials, you don't get everything, you get some financials. So you don't have all the data points, but you have enough, like Whitney said, to do some analysis. And that can lead to a strong letter of intent. So remember, it's binding. It's non-binding in the sense that you can walk away from the transaction, but all the terms of the letter of intent get transferred to the APA. So don't just submit it without really thinking it through. After the letter of intent, your letter of intent is accepted, there might be some back and forth, but let's say it's accepted, we move towards the asset purchase agreement, and usually brokers will prepare the first draft of the asset purchase agreement, or the seller's lawyer will prepare the first draft of the asset purchase agreement, and we're going to get into that in a second. But that is the bulk where the time is spent is negotiating that document. And the key to negotiating the asset purchase agreement, keeping it efficient, keeping legal costs down, keeping the time frame short, is to make sure that your letter of intent is strong. If your letter of intent is strong and has a lot of the key terms, then we can just focus on the legal aspects of the asset purchase agreement as opposed to the business terms. And that's an important part of this calculation. It definitely is. Then there's the exhibits. The exhibits, as a seller, I'll tell you, is a huge part of it. You know, you need to spend some time making sure that your exhibits are completely filled out correctly. That includes the correct information about your team, equipment lists, you know, making sure your continuing liabilities are listed there. So it takes some time to put it together. It's not always easy, and people sometimes wait until the end, but it is an important part of the documents. It's often overlooked, unfortunately. And that includes, you know, when we talk about an equipment list, there's a lot of things in there that you may want to keep. Obviously, there's the personal stuff like the diplomas and the and those kinds of things, your personal computer maybe at the office. But there's other things, too, that you may not want to sell as part of the practice. And so it's important to have that listed as an excluded item in the exhibits. The next is a lease assignment. So as a buyer, you know, it's important to know whether you're going to get a lease assignment from the landlord or if you're going to sign a brand new lease with a landlord. And you can't make that determination up front. It's an important analysis to go through once we get into it, as we need to look and see if the seller has a really good lease. And then if they do, we just will get an assignment. because we don't want a new lease, because a new lease will probably be worse than maybe the lease that they have. If they have a not so great lease, then maybe we shoot for a new lease with the landlord, which will take a little bit more time in terms of negotiating, but you can get potentially really, really good terms. As a seller, make sure that you have looked at your lease. We'll talk about that in a bit. But make sure you've looked at your lease, that you have some sort of relationship with the landlord, because we're going to need their cooperation. And then finally, if you're a seller and you're planning on working back at the office, either for a transitional period or more long-term, if it's a larger practice, then you need an associate agreement. So this is sort of the world, the legal world, when we're talking about buying and selling a practice. There's some other ancillary documents that sometimes come into play, but these are really the key. So let's get into the most important legal terms that we're going to go through. We're going to go through about five of these. So the first thing is the one that I probably get the most question about, which is the restricted covenant. So as most of you probably know, in California, it is totally illegal, completely illegal, no way around it, to have a restricted covenant in an employment agreement. So what that means is that if you've got employees, either an associate, a hygienist, an RDA, DA, you cannot have a restricted covenant in that agreement. What that means is that they can leave, and if they're an associate, they can open up next door to you, upstairs, downstairs, wherever, and there's nothing you can do about that. It's been compared to slavery here in California, so there's literally no way around that rule. There is one exception, well, actually there's three exceptions, but there's one exception that applies to dentistry, and that exception is that as a buyer of a business where goodwill is being sold, which is always the case in dental practices, as a buyer, you can prevent the seller from competing against you. And when you think about it, that makes a lot of sense. As a society, we wouldn't want people to sell their practices and then go open up down the street, of course, right? Because all the patients would follow them. So the question is, what should those mileages be? Well, it's different all across the state. And you know, if you're in downtown San Francisco, it's going to be a different number than if you're in the rural parts of the state. But the general rule is that it's anywhere from 5 to 25 miles, okay, and for about 5 years. The 5 years is pretty standard in the industry right now. Sometimes we'll see some people try to get 3 years, but really 5 years is pretty standard. But the 5 to 25 miles is about the range. Now, where this becomes really problematic, as you guys might imagine, is that if I'm a seller, right? If I'm a seller and I'm telling my buyers, hey, I want to sell my practice because I'm retiring. I plan on going to Maui and retiring there, or Arizona or Utah or wherever. Right? And then I start negotiating on the covenant not to compete. Joanne, what does that tell you if someone starts negotiating on the covenant not to compete and they're telling everybody that they're retiring?
They're going to set up shop somewhere, huh?
They're going to set up shop somewhere. They are going to set up shop somewhere. And I will tell you, 9 out of 10 times, and the only reason I say 9 out of 10 is because life is never 10 out of 10. But 9 out of 10 times, if someone is negotiating this restricted covenant, they have other plans. They have other plans. So why would you ever, as a seller, put yourself in that position? You will lose the trust of every buyer that walks through the door, every lawyer that walks through the door, every banker that walks through the door. And guess what? We are dealing with most of the buyers out there. So if one of my buyers is not buying your practice, I can guarantee you another one of my buyers may be looking at your practice, especially if you're a law firm like ours, which is heavily focused on buyers. And so we will know those kinds of things. So here's my advice. If you're a seller, be honest. Be honest with Whitney, right? Be honest with everybody. If you're planning on working for your best friend 20 miles away, cool. We don't care. The buyer will probably be okay with that as long as you're honest about it, right? As long as you're honest about it. But if you hide the ball and you try to negotiate this covenant not to compete, I guarantee you the deal will be much more complex than you want. right? Much more complex, because there's an immediate lack of trust that develops when that is the case, right? That is the case. So you know, I think it's smart to, you know, be straightforward about this and be honest about it. And remember, the bank, the lawyers, the CPA, the consultants, the buyer especially, has a lot of money on the line here, right? Has a lot of money on the line. So this is one of the most important parts of any purchase agreement. And so it's really important, really, really important that everyone's on the same page about it. And the reality is look, you know, most of you have fantastic practices and you have really loyal patients. A patient will drive 5 miles to go see you. I mean, quite honestly, they'll drive probably 25 miles to go see you, because finding a good dentist is not easy to do. And most of you who have, you know, who know me and who have been following me, you know, with our videos through COVID and before, or have seen me speak at CDA, you know that my wife is a pediatric dentist up here. And so I live your life and I know what loyalty these patients have. And you have patients probably driving from an hour away, if not longer. And so, you know, don't get bent out of shape if your goodwill is so strong that, you know, the buyer is afraid of you opening up shop. It's a normal part of this process. All right, let's go into the allocation. Travis talked about this a little bit. You know, I want to make sure that, you know, all the buyers out there know that, you know, this sometimes, you know, sometimes your CPAs, if you go, you know, down the road of hiring a CPA that's not experienced in dental, you know, they'll sometimes get bent out of shape about this. This is one of the main reasons why we recommend always hiring a dental CPA like Travis, because they will tell you what I'm about to tell you, which is, as a buyer, the allocation of the purchase price means very, very little to you, because you're going to get those write-offs one way or another. For the seller, however, it could be tens of thousands of dollars of extra tax that they pay. So let me tell you what the standards are, more or less. So the typical numbers, the breakdown between tangible and intangible, and for those of you that don't know, a tangible asset is something that you can put your hand on, right? It's tangible, like pieces of equipment, supplies, and whatnot. Intangible are assets that you can't put your hands on, like goodwill and patient lists and whatnot. The tangible assets are taxed at the normal tax rates, whereas intangible is taxed at long-term capital gain rates as of right now. So you can imagine what a big delta that is. You know, long-term capital gains before the Biden administration is 20%, and your normal sort of going tax rate is you know, anywhere, you know, up to 45% or whatnot. You know, if you take into account California's state taxes on top of that, it might be closer to even 50. But my point is that there's a big delta between these two. So how do you divide the purchase price? Well, the average or the common split is 80-20. So 20% to tangible, 80% towards intangible, okay? So 80-20 is sort of the starting point. Now, the minimum, right? Or not the minimum, I should say, the maximum in terms of the percentages should be 90-10. 90 intangible, 10 tangible. In 20 years of doing this, which I can't even believe I'm saying that out loud, but in 20 years of doing this, and I can tell you, I have had one person, one client get audited by the IRS as a result of a transition. And we've done 8,000 transitions probably, right? We have 8,000 clients, probably like maybe 4,000 transitions or something around those range. One person. And you know why? They got audited because they went lower than 10% on the tangible. In other words, they crossed that line that I think, and Travis, it'd be interesting to see what your viewpoint on this is. I think that's pushing the envelope too much as far as the IRS is concerned. And then suddenly alarms went off that, you know, they were pushing the envelope. So in my experience, at least 90-10, if not, you know, higher than that. So keep that in mind. This is really important for sellers. For buyers, you know, a little bit less important because you get the deductions as Travis had mentioned. Let's go to accounts receivables. Account receivables are the monies that patients owe you, different than contract receivables for those of you that are orthodontists or do a lot of Invisalign. Okay, just kind of keep that in mind. But accounts receivables are monies that patients are owe the practice. If we're not big fans of our buyers buying accounts receivables from sellers for a lot of variety of reasons, but if they don't buy it, then usually the buyer will collect accounts receivables for the seller anywhere from 90 to 180 days. And the seller will pay the buyer about 5% for that work. So for collecting, for postage, you know, for the employee's time and so on and so forth. And usually it's a month-to-month calculation. You know, the checks come in, the buyer holds on to the checks, figures out, you know, posts them to the account and then gives them to the seller. And then the seller pays them 5% for whatever has been collected. After that 90 to 180 day period expires, the seller gets all the AR that's left, and then they usually go and try to collect it themselves. My recommendation to all of you sellers out there, please don't go to collection companies and things of that nature if you don't have to. I can't tell you how many dental board cases we've seen with patients who are just really upset that this doctor has sold their practice and now is sending them to collections on top of that. It doesn't go anywhere. I'll be honest. You know, we're really good at defending dental board cases, but I'll tell you, it's a problem. I mean, it's something you don't want to deal with in retirement. So I would kind of forget about that. Retreatment, is an issue, you know, so, you know, retreatment is negotiated between the buyer and seller, like most other terms. A lot of times, the sellers will not want to do their own retreatment. I actually think that's not a, you know, I don't think that's a great idea. I think if you can do your own retreatment, I think it's a good idea to do, from a malpractice perspective. I think it's a great idea to do. And also from a patient management perspective, if there's been a lot of situations, where the buyer has mishandled a retreatment with a patient and the patient has gone and filed, you know, a complaint with the board or done other things. So, you know, keep that in mind. You know, there's usually a process for retreatment. You know, the buyer will present the case to you as the seller. You analyze the case. If you think that, yes, you know, retreatment is proper here, then you can decide as a seller whether you should do it or whether the buyer should do it. The buyer then has the choice of doing it themselves or not doing it at all and referring it out, which again, it goes back to my original point. As a seller, I'd love to keep control of that patient and make sure they're happy. I mean, mistakes happen. Things happen. And so, you know, if you can fix it yourself, I would recommend you do that. So keep that in mind. I'll end on a couple of really big points. The lease is, I can't tell you how many sellers we see that have not looked at their lease. I know Whitney makes all of her sellers look at their leases. She looks at the leases herself as well. But, you know, you need to know when it ends, right? Absolutely. Keep an eye on that ball. If you're a seller, you got to know when it ends. And my recommendation is that if you're thinking about selling right now, which, by the way, it's a great time to sell, right? It's a great time to sell, not because of taxes, not because of anything, but because it's just an awesome time. There are so many buyers out there, qualified buyers, and the banks have really cheap money. And so there are people who are buying practices left and right, not because they're getting them for the cheap. They're paying fair market value, but they're doing it because there's not a lot of good opportunities for, you know, starting up from scratch right now in California. It's just really expensive. So if you're thinking of selling, this is the time to talk to Whitney and Joanne and kind of get the ball rolling. But make sure you look at your lease end date. Ideally, you'd want to sell a year to 2 years before the end of your lease. The reason for that is, as a seller, your liability is super limited to, you know, to only those years on your lease. And then for the buyer, it gives them a lot of negotiation power to renegotiate the lease during the transition for another 5, 10, 15, 20 years. And so if you can time it, that would be great. The worst thing would be finding out that your lease is going to expire in 6 months and then trying to sell it quickly and not being able to, and then turning around and having to sign another 5-year lease. So that would be pretty bad. So just keep an eye on your end of your lease. Do you have any options left? Are they assignable options or are they not assignable to a buyer? Hugely important. And then how is your landlord, right? Is it the Irvine company that's going to try to take every last dime from the buyers? Or is it a mom and pop landlord that you can have a really good relationship with and transition the buyer into it? Huge, you know, really important items. So finally, let's talk about employees. As most of you know, you know, we do a lot of work on the HR side. And so there is an art to telling your employees if you're a seller, when you're transitioning. And our recommendation is that, you know, you wait until all the documents are signed, the purchase agreement, the sales the lease contract, everything is sort of signed and into escrow's hand. And then you notify your employees. And the reason is because deals fall apart, you never know whether it's a lending issue or other issues. So keep it in mind, you know, don't tell your employees until the end. And there's a couple of reasons. One is it might spook them. They might get scared about doing a transition with a new buyer. And then if they leave, you know, they quit or they look for another job or they just get really mad at you. Guess who gets really nervous? It's going to be the buyer. Right? It's going to be the buyer. And you don't want to spook the buyer, you know, going into a transition. And then the other thing is, you know, make sure you're compliant with all the HR laws out there. I know you're selling your practice or you're thinking of selling it. And you're like, oh, I'm going to be done with all of this. But remember, there's a 3-year statute of limitations. And it's incredible how many claims we see after people sell their practices. Employees who have been with you for 10, 15, 20, sometimes 25 years, get really upset that you have sold your practice and are moving on and they're still in the practice. There's like an emotional toll that it takes on them. And so we see a lot of lawsuits after people have sold their practice. And I had a famous case in Sacramento, many of you may have heard about, where one of our doctors got sued 7 times by his employees once he retired. He was in such debt after these 7 lawsuits that he had to go in retirement, open up a new office just to fill his retirement buckets again. It was a disaster. And the funny thing about that whole case was that they had nothing bad to say about him. They loved him. They loved his wife. They were absolutely in love with them. But they, almost all of them said, look, you know, he's retired. He's off, you know, but we didn't get our overtime. We didn't get this. We didn't get that. And we want a piece of that now. You know, we never thought he would leave us. And so make sure you reach out to me if you're concerned about HR. We'll make sure you get HR compliant. So as we end tonight, I want to talk to the buyers out there about what I call the buyer's due diligence, which is the homework you have to do on every practice you buy. And it really comes down to 3 major things. And if anybody's interested, I've got a lot of strong white papers on this topic that goes into great detail that I'm happy to send you. But here's how it breaks down. The first step is the financial due diligence. And the financial due diligence occurs, by the way, all of these due diligence occur after your letter of intent has been accepted as we're negotiating the lease and the purchase contract. But the financial due diligence is your CPA, your dental CPA like Travis, and also your bank, dental bank, looking at all the financials of the office, right? So they look at the P&Ls, the tax returns, you know, the balance sheets, all of that. They will determine whether the numbers make sense. And the reason why you want a strong dental CPA is because they'll notice things that other CPAs won't notice. Are the expenses for the supplies match the revenues of the office and so on and so forth? Hugely important. Then there's the legal portion. That's my portion. Contracts, leases, all of those things that we were talking about. And then there's the practice management due diligence. At least that's what I call it. And this is where you need a strong dental management coach, right? You know, you need a consultant like Joanne to go in and do an analysis for you as the buyer. Now, this is different. This is a different service than some of the other dental consultants out there that you may have heard about. right, that charge 30, 40, 50,000. That's not what we're talking about here. You need a specialist like Joanne that comes in and just does the transition analysis for you and goes into great detail into what this practice is all about, the goods and the bads. And one of the things I love about Joanne's report, quite honestly, more so than anybody else's, is that it doesn't just tell you as the buyer what's wrong with the practice, but or what's good about the practice, but it tells you opportunities you have to immediately improve the office after you buy it. And that's a huge part, right? That's a huge part because, you know, when Whitney sells a practice, they're not perfect. They all have problems, right? They may not be reappointing hygiene. They may be having other problems. It doesn't make it a bad practice. It just makes it a practice that needs some TLC. And that means that you as the buyer can use this report that Joanne will create for you as the opportunity to improve the practice immediately. And I've seen doctors make $60,000, $70,000 with small, small increases in just how the office is run. And I'm not the expert in that. That's all Joanne. So we refer everybody out in that sense because it's an important report to have in your hand. But please do not skip that third due diligence. Never, ever skip it. It's a vital part of it. All right. In sum, we come down to these major points that everyone has talked about tonight. Have your transition team ready, right? So you know, whether you're a seller, you're a buyer, you need your team. So make sure you're preparing your financials, check all your employee records. If you need stuff, let us know. We'll make sure you get dialed into that. Speak to your financial advisor if you're a seller so you can figure out what to do with your monies. Same thing on the estate planning. And then whether you're a buyer or your seller, figure out what you're going to do after the close of escrow. Are you going to, you know, what's your first day in the office going to be like? What's your first day in retirement going to be like? Huge questions. So for those of you that are interested, if you're selling your practice, if you text the word practice sale, just one word, right? It's not two words. If you text the word practice sale to 44222, you'll get a white paper I wrote on how to sell your practice intelligently and strategically. For those of you that are buyers in the room, go ahead and text the word practice purchase to that same number, 44222, and you'll get that white paper in your email as well. No strings attached. It's just purely a gift for you guys. So feel free to do either practice sale or practice purchase, and you'll be on your way. And of course, here's my info. If any of you have any questions for me, I'm always available to speak to you guys and consult with you and strategize. So thank you again, Joanne, for putting all this together. This was an incredible effort. Thank you, Bill, for producing it as well. You guys are awesome.
Thank you, Ali. Yes, Bill Fukui with MedChart Digital. They specialize in helping dentists with their online digital marketing. And thank you, everyone, for attending. You'll be receiving the recording. Travis, we appreciate you taking time out of your busy tax season. Whitney, a pleasure to have you.
Thank you, Bill.
Anything else?
No, I just want to say thank you for everybody's patience for any of the technical glitches earlier. I think there was a ton of really good information. I've been in the dental marketing and just the dental industry in general for about 25 years. And really, you guys touched on stuff that, you know, I've talked to practices as it relates, because a lot of them are trying to grow their practice to the point where they do want to sell, or they're looking at buying practices with a lot of upside, whether it's location or whatnot. But you guys touched on some really good stuff. So I actually learned a lot myself. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. Good night.
Thank you.